You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. If you asked most people, they would think of many things before they decided to mention hairy bipeds and the potential for them to be roaming around the state of Texas. Yet this state has a rich history of encounters that stretch back over 200 years that show that the Lone Star State has some incredible accounts of Bigfoot. Lyle Blackburn makes a long-awaited return to the show to discuss his brilliant new book, Texas Bigfoot, as he guides us through some of Texas's most compelling Bigfoot accounts. Before we join Lyle, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link on the show notes as usual. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, updates, episodes, and merchandise. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Mastodon. And please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. They say everything is bigger in Texas. And it seemed Bigfoot may be the state's biggest mystery of all. For nearly 200 years, residents of the Lone Star State have been reporting a variety of encounters with strange hair-covered beasts all across the state. Texas is often incorrectly assumed to be a dry and arid expanse, and yet its ecology is some of the most diverse in the lower 48. And who better to be our guide across the second largest of all the US states than our good friend, Lyle Blackburn. Lyle, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Lyle. One of those people, I'm always excited to see what your next project is, and being slightly jealous of how multi-talented you are. So I was delighted when I saw the book, because I either missed what was going on, because I know the last time we spoke, you said you got a couple of projects on the go. So when it appeared on my email list that this new book was coming out, the first thing I thought was, I can't think of anybody better to write this book.
Right. I figured I was qualified, being a lifelong Texan. I even wear a cowboy hat. So, after looking into, various cryptid and Bigfoot cases and writing books about things that occurred in other states, I thought, it's high time that somebody wrote the definitive Texas Bigfoot Bigfoot book that covered all the cases and all the kind of history throughout the years. And so I just finally, I know I'd been gathering stuff over time or just paying attention or gathering up old newspaper articles and obviously interviewing some people myself. So finally I just said, time is right. Let's just do this thing.
Mm. Do you think it was the book that you've been wanting to write for a while, because obviously you've been diving into some amazing cryptid cases over the years and you've wrote some phenomenal works, primarily linked mostly, I would imagine, with your wonderful work on Boggy Creek, but also some of the other cases you've done. So for me, this just feels like a really natural next book from you.
Yeah, surely. I mean, it was something that, I guess in some ways I felt I would probably always write. And I just, felt the time. I try, even though my cases have sort of concentrated on a certain area or stuff, I try not to be too regional, or to confine myself to a single state. But the way it is with Texas and sort of the variety and the unique landscape and how big the state is and sort of just in some ways, the iconic reputation of the state, I felt, this is a book that it's not just going to appeal to Texans, but it's something that would appeal to anyone who's into this phenomenon and anybody who enjoys this kind of mystery or the subject of Bigfoot and these creatures, because certainly the Lone Star State has a very varied and exciting and dynamic history of Bigfoot sightings.
Yeah. I mean, Texas is one of those states, as I said on my introduction, a lot of people just have the really wrong idea, especially outside of the US, Lyle, about Texas. I think most people's knowledge in the UK is based on watching Dallas in the 80s. So they assume the entire state's just dusty and full of oil wells everywhere, which is deeply unfair, I think, to the people that live there in the state, because it's got such a variation, as I said, in the whole habitat that this state has everything, really. And I think once you dive into looking at just how lush and beautiful some parts of Texas are, a lot of people tend to be surprised. So as a native Texan, Lyle, are you sick to death of people thinking bad things about the state of the land in your home state?
Well, you know, I don't know that I get it. You know, it's sort of like people's impression is just built from what they see. And, you know, I learned early on of sort of the stereotype of what people thought about Texas when I was touring with my bands and touring Europe and stuff, because, you know, oh man, you know, do you own horses? Do you have a ranch? Or, they wanted to know. There's always kind of that.
Yeah.
So that was the go-to. But that's cool. That's just sort of what Texas is known for. And it's a cowboy spirit, the rugged plains and the oil drives and all that stuff. So that's just what comes to mind. But most people don't think, you know, how forested it is, how much forest there is in the eastern portions and stuff like that. But that's, you know, that place, I guess, second in the famous sort of cowboy motif that it gives off. And so I'm certainly proud to be a Texan, and everybody was always interested. You know, it's not, if you were from some other state, like, I don't know, I don't want to demean any other states, but if I was, like, our band was from Rhode Island and we were touring around, I don't think people would have been asking, what is it like? And, you know, it's more like, you're from Texas, you know, what is it like there? And people wanted to know, so it just had sort of a reputation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more you learn about Texas, the more interesting it becomes, because it's a place that's steeped and deeply ingrained in American history, especially in the modern era, through the rise of the country, the rise of the state, the troubles and the politics that it's been involved in and found itself in over its birth and continued growth throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. And yet, it's also a state with a rich history of hauntings, which I think, outside of people like ourselves who love Bigfoot, I think if you think about strange things in Texas, most people either think of UFOs or hauntings, because, you know, you've got cities like San Antonio, which is renowned for being haunted.
True. Yeah, there's those aspects too, the paranormal, if you will. And yeah, there's some great, really almost scary UFO incidents that have occurred in the state, and certainly, you know, the haunted thing. And I think a lot of times when you have these old hotels and saloons and places like that, you always have hauntings, and certainly Texas has that sort of thing. And so those usually take, I don't know, that's true. You know, those are something people are aware of more generally about Texas than Bigfoot, you know?
Well, not for long if this book's anything to go by, Lyle.
Well, hopefully so. And that's one reason I felt that the book, it wasn't something, you know, I certainly could write a book that's sort of my experiences about Bigfoot in Texas, but the approach I wanted to take was not that. I wanted to cover what is the history of the sightings, where, you know, and go into the various regions and discuss, you know, things that have been on record or gotten news reports or been in, you know, notable throughout, and to try to cross section of what I felt that were the most credible and or done, you know, sensational sightings that I've come across. So it was something I sort of wrote in a journalistic approach rather than, okay, you know, I went to the woods and this happened. Less of that and more of, here is the total crazy history of hairy bipedal creature sightings in the Lone Star State.
Well, as always as well, once again, this is another collection of accounts and newspaper articles that clearly show, once again, that a lot of people were bumping into strange things nearly 200 years ago, as I said. So Texas is not alone in the fact that, like several other states in the US, people were having strange encounters in those early days of the 19th century. And obviously, one of the most famous of the early reports is this wonderful repeating experience of the Wild Woman of the Navidad.
Right. And, you know, that is the case where really all throughout the southern states, you would have people reporting sightings of some sort of hairy, upright, human-like, animal-like creatures. But, you know, those days there was no term for Bigfoot. So if there was any coverage, it was always in terms of sort of like the wild men or something. And one of the earliest ones I found for Texas where people mentioned this that was recorded was the Wild Woman of the Navidad, which is a case that started around 1837 in the southeast area of Texas along the Navidad River. And people began to see some sort of hair-covered creatures, if you will, in the woods and in the area. And they were leaving footprints, and they'd find these human-like footprints, various times, and it appeared to be more than one individual. So over the years, they, you know, were sort of perplexed by what it was. Was it some kind of an unknown creature, or was it like a feral human? They weren't really sure. And so as Texans will do, a hunting party was organized, and they even attempted to lasso one of these creatures, you know, on one occasion when it was sighted, and it was, it escaped, evaded capture. It was just simply too fast, and they couldn't even lasso it. And so, you know, it sort of disappeared, and there was some newspapers that would report this at the time. So that's how we even know about it, is luckily some newspaper articles. So, but ultimately, you know, kind of unsolved. And all we can do is look back and say, well, it definitely fits the description of Bigfoot. We can't say for sure that that was what we would call the equivalent of Bigfoot today, but it certainly began that story of sightings of these type of creatures, even in Texas.
Yeah. And there's some lovely little strange things about this, is that some of the people that were having these encounters, because it seemed that things were being stolen, like trinkets, which would lead into some more modern reports where people claim that hairy bipeds are attracted to shiny things or marbles or wind chimes and things like that, Lyle. So it's interesting when we look at these early reports that people were saying that they were having trinkets stolen. But I had to chuckle when people said, oh, well, it must be some kind of animal with human-type feet, which I think just shows you sometimes the lengths people will go to try and explain something weird by describing something even weirder.
Right. You know, and that, yeah, this does have some extra details to this case. It wasn't just simply people saw this, these creatures in the woods. They, you know, things were being stolen from the house, which was, again, kind of provided fuel on the fire of the debate, whether it was a feral human trying to live off the land and would come and steal stuff, or was it like a creature that was attracted to some of the development there with houses and things, and may have been sneaking up either looking for food and then stealing, you know, shiny trinkets, who knows? But, you know, that it just adds to that story for sure.
Mm. Well, I suppose one of the other really early reports that comes out of this particular period is obviously somebody who is synonymous with Texas outside of the US, which is Davy Crockett, obviously. And it's very interesting for me, Lyle, the amount of times I've come across this story, and yet you seem to be one of the few people, which I would not be surprised by, to be honest, who has printed the full account, because often it seems that some people cut a rather intriguing portion of this letter that he wrote to his brother, I think it was. Because obviously a lot of people put this forward as that Davy Crockett had an encounter with a Bigfoot. But if you read the full letter that he wrote, it gives a very different slant to it. Although I know when you're discussing it in the book, you're sort of conjecturing as to why he described seeing such a creature, didn't he?
Right. You know, and I try to just include the whole thing. I'm not, you know, if you were trying to really skew it so it made it sound like he had a sighting, then certainly if you cut out parts of the whole letter, then it may forward that agenda. But I don't want to do that. I just say this is related to Bigfoot, but doesn't necessarily mean he saw Bigfoot. But therein, the whole him even talking about that he saw something appear in front of him in sort of a dreamlike state as he was, you know, hiking through the Texas area and said it was an ape-like creature of any sort is just very bizarre. Where, you know, he said it was covered in hair and teeth and, you know, stood upright like a large ape man. Literally, the word is large ape man. He's just like, how, why was he, where did he get that idea from? I mean, was he influenced by somebody who had a sighting like that? Or did he actually experience something? Who knows? So it's just weird. And of course, Davy Crockett being such a prominent figure of the Texas Revolution that, you know, this story obviously had to be in this book just because it's related.
Yeah. I have to chuckle at reading some portions of his letter because he's convinced that this might have more to do with some dodgy beef or hog that he's eaten. And so he said, oh, well, I've decided I had such a funny reaction to that. I didn't have any more for the next couple of days.
Right. You know, you see that a lot of times in people with some older writings where they talk about they eat this or that, and then it gives them trouble, like weird dreams and all this stuff. I don't know. They must. And I'm sure the food back then was not very well preserved, or it could spoil easily. So it's true that, yeah, this, eating something was a risk and could give you like hallucinogenic effects. You know this.
Yeah. Well, I think it is one of those things. And when we're talking about this period in American history, you know, without wishing to make people seem daft in the modern era, I think a lot of people tend to forget just how tough it was for these people out on the frontier, like when they were going places. They usually took what they could carry, and that was it. And anything else that they were fortunate enough to come across, they would either hunt it to purely for food, or they would try and trade things off to get something else. So it surprises me that there aren't. But then again, you would suggest that surely more people would be seeing all kinds of strange things with how poorly preserved the food was back then. And we don't tend to get as many kind of reports, do we?
No, you know, you would think if that was something and more notable that they incurring all the time, there'd be more reports. But yeah, you know, it's funny about all that because I do sometimes when I'm out, you know, in the great outdoors or hiking or doing research or camping, I always think about, God, I've got it so easy. You know, I've got these warm boots and, you know, good equipment and my waterproof tent, all this stuff. And I'm thinking, man, what was it like for Davy Crockett and some of those guys who just sort of had to live off the land? There was no convenience stores or fast food. If you wanted to survive and eat, you better shoot something and you better be a good shot.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have a tent. You laid on the ground on some crummy blanket. I just think, yeah, man, I got it so easy. Those guys were just rugged.
Yeah. Puts us all to shame really loud, doesn't it?
It really does. And so you try not to complain about our modern conveniences, like, you know, because we got to appreciate what we have because they had it so much harder.
Yeah, yeah. The next time we complain about them only having specific types of soda in a shop makes us all seem a little bit churlish, really, doesn't it?
Exactly.
I think for me, Lyle, that the story that pulled me in towards strange creatures in Texas is obviously probably one of the most infamous of modern cryptid flaps, especially in Texas, which is everything that goes off in Lake Worth. back at the end of the 60s, because this is one of those cases where you've got about three different, it seems on face value, Lyle, that there's three different types of creatures running about, because people keep saying different things, and you get some incredible alleged explanations, which some of the ones put out here always make me laugh. Especially the bobcat explanation, which has never sat well with me in any regard regarding anything that goes on in this particular case, Lyle. So for anybody who's unaware, what on earth was going on this hot summer of 1969?
So, yeah, you know, the Lake Worth Monster case of 1969 is one of the most famous unexplained creature cases that's ever been in Texas. And, you know, one reason for that is it was covered in the newspapers at the time. And also a woman named Sally Ann Clark wrote a book which kind of preserved and added the information to be, you know, part of, I guess, in some ways, the Bigfoot study. This continued. But yeah, basically people were reporting seeing some sort of a creature that most of them said it was big, walked upright, and was covered in white hair, sort of like a white Bigfoot, if you will. But some said it was scaly, it had horns, other like bizarre sort of variations and descriptions that people often call it the Lake Worth Goat Man. Instead, but you know, that makes it just confusing enough, because you're already trying to figure out, well, is this a Bigfoot? Is it a Bigfoot that has white hair, or, you know, or just what the heck was it? But no doubt about it, people were seeing something that was running around, and even at one point, upwards of 30 people saw this thing run across a ridge out there in the Lake Worth woods area, and people were seeing it, you know, on a regular basis. And there was even a photograph of this alleged creature taken in November of 1969, which stands as really one of the most intriguing Bigfoot photos ever taken, at least the old one, especially back at that time. And, you know, over the years, I've looked into this and even interviewed people who were actually there during those times and, you know, had experiences or just told me about the case. And, you know, of course, like any of these cases, a bunch of people come forward. Oh, that was me. It worked my brother. He was pulling the hoax, and it was all this really preposterous explanations for it. Or people say, well, you know, there was no monster. I'm like, well, something was going on, because this wasn't a mass hallucination, and people were seeing something that is to this day just unexplained.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, as you just mentioned, Sally Ann Clark's work, it, for me, it's one of those moments in cryptozoological history that you've really just got to be thankful for, because I think if she hadn't have done the work that she did and did the interviews, because she just turned up with a notebook and started speaking to the witnesses, we'd have lost a lot of these witness reports, wouldn't we?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was instrumental in preserving this history and covering a lot of the stuff that the newspapers did not cover. Really, the newspapers only covered about a couple of days worth of incidents, but it went on for months from the summer of 69 all towards the winter of people having experiences. So without her, I think it wouldn't be as famous, because it was a lot of these kind of cases in Texas, and some of them get, you know, some of them are known widely, and so hard. I think in this case, it was definitely because of the book.
Mm. I mean, also as well, one of the other interesting aspects that always made me raise my eyebrows when I first read about this is the involvement of Jim Mars, who was, I think, was he working on a local newspaper at the time, Lyle?
Yes, he worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and so he was a writer at the time, and he covered the Lake Worth Monster case, and the original couple of major articles were written by him. And of course, he went on to write some interesting books in the sort of conspiracy and UFO sort of world. And he was a really nice guy. I met him a couple of times before he passed away. And, you know, one of those guys who was instrumental in cataloging and preserving some of this history by those articles.
Hmm. Do you think it's one of the most frustrating cases as well, Lyle? Because as you've touched on there, there's so many people who've either come forward to say it was them. I mean, that you've got somebody claiming it was her brother wearing white shorts and a t-shirt and eye makeup. You've got somebody claiming that, because obviously one of the key incidents in this particular monster flap is this incident with the tire. And somebody was claiming that it was them that threw this tire, and it took a lucky bounce, which is why it ended up going as far as it did. You've got people saying that they were wearing a suit. It's such a messy case when you get all these, and that's before you even get to the skeptical explanations, which make even less sense.
Yeah, I mean, it does make it frustrating because we strive to know the truth and we want to solve these mysteries, but it doesn't help when not just one person proposes some explanation, but multiple people, and hardly any of them sound very plausible. I mean, the creature is almost more plausible than some kid in some white underwear with eye makeup on swinging from trees. I mean, people just don't mistake that for a hairy monster. It's just, I don't know. I saw a kid swinging from a tree, it would pretty much look like a kid swinging from a tree. I'm sorry.
And you've got a question. Just what were these kids doing with their spare time that they were able? Because I think, wasn't he supposed to be 11 years old? And you're thinking, well, how is an 11-year-old being able to work out how to set up a rig and pulley line that could get somebody else to pull him around, terrifying people?
So, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's just totally ridiculous. And in Lake Worth, Greer Island, where this took place, it was sort of a lover's lane hangout. And why would this kid be out there? Anyway, you needed a car to get there. So, you know, unless your family's going down to a dark, wooded area at night, like where people drink beer and hang out. I mean, it just makes no sense.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things about this case is you have several people who claim it's them. So you think, well, you all can't be responsible for this as well. This is the other aspect of this, that people come forward and say, yeah, it was me, but somebody else has said it was them. So either you're both lying or one of you's definitely lying, because you can't both be the hoax. This is the other thing that often you will get, the hoax will be the hoax, Lyle.
Yeah, if one person proposed, you know, and had a plausible explanation or produced a costume or whatever, you go, okay, well, there you go. You know, in the dark of night, this guy fooled people. But when you have multiple people claiming the same thing and with sort of wild explanations, you almost tend to just say, okay, this sounds like people trying to claim credit for something, and which people will do. They will claim credit. I mean, you've got nutballs who will claim credit for serial killings. I mean,
yeah.
People have this sort of want the attention or whatever it is to come forward and say, oh, well, that was me, you know, and here's how I did it. But that is a phenomenon, and people will claim credit for something they absolutely didn't do.
Yeah, it's a very interesting psychological aspect, because like you say, there are, I would imagine, every police force that's had the misfortune of dealing with a serious crime or a serial killer case, like, will have to deal with people saying, yeah, it's me, I'm the one, I'm your person, I'm the killer. And like you say, they've either clearly know it's not them, that the evidence doesn't match, they only know what they've read in the press, those type of people. And you think, even if we're talking in such serious crimes, even when we're talking about cryptids and UFO sightings and things like that, people will still try and insert themselves into stories for whatever reason. It's a very strange thing that human nature attracts certain people to even.
Right. And I mean, this isn't the only case. I wrote the book on the Bishopville Lizzie Man in South Carolina. And you have the same thing where you have multiple people either claiming credit or people saying that it was this one certain person. Yet their explanations don't account for all the sightings. They don't really, they're not positive. It's literally the same exact thing. So I think it's something that's not exclusive to the Lake Worth Monster case. It happens in other cases, even Boggy Creek, you know, that was my cousin in a suit. Well, you know, is your cousin 100 years old? Sightings for 100 years. It just doesn't add up.
Well, that's the thing with this particular case as well, is that once Sally started doing some digging, she found out that people were reporting having strange encounters around this area with something that people were calling the Muddy Monster or the Mud Monster as well, which then shows that people were clearly having weird experiences here even before the summer of 69.
Right, which is, again, something you find in these cases where people will mention sightings that were predated, you know, whatever incidents that were covered in the newspapers. And in the Lake Worth Monster case, likewise, people called, had a, supposedly some creature was down there and they called it a different name. But, you know, it's sort of Kunan, you know, credibility to something that didn't just pop out of nowhere. He had previous sightings as well.
Hmm. And you've also, as we mentioned, got two skeptical explanations, neither of which seem to you just think, if you can't say anything sensible, Lyle, don't say anything at all, regardless of whether you're a scientist or not. I mean, one chap said, oh, well, it's a bobcat. And I know you've mentioned it on both your podcast and in the book. Well, that might account for the cries, but it doesn't account to what people were seeing, and they were clearly not seeing a bobcat.
Right. I mean, it's like you're just not going to mistake a bobcat for a 6-foot-tall, upright, white creature. It just doesn't, that doesn't add up. But those are people who, you know, they just ask somebody who's already skeptical, and they'll just throw you some, you know, what they believe is an educated answer, but it, you know, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, was it a macaque as well? Somebody said, oh yeah, it's a macaque on the loose. And you're like, well, I know enough about monkeys and apes to know that a macaque is not a very big creature in the scheme of things, and certainly not 6 foot tall.
Right. Yeah. The monkey explanation is also just doesn't seem to match up with what people described. You know, if it was just one incident and something jumped on somebody's car real fast and jumped off and that was it, then you might say, well, okay, maybe it was a monkey, but there's too many people with reports. And there's a photo which shows an upright, it's kind of a blurry, but it's a whitish looking thing, and it's way bigger than a monkey. So I don't know how people expect the monkey explanation to stand up either.
Yeah. I think there's one aspect of some of these cases, because the other one I want to touch on, which has always interested me as well in this particular period of time in the 60s, is the Sherman Gorilla, Lyle. Primarily because this particular case shows the dangers of excitable teenagers running around in furry suits, if we're led to believe that that's all that went on at Lake Worth. Because obviously in the Sherman Gorilla, one of the first witnesses who came forward said he'd shot it 3 times.
Right, yeah, this was a case predating the Lake Worth monster case. This happened in the 1960s, and this came to my attention through a newspaper article that was sort of dug up. And this was in northeast Texas in that little town called Sherman, in which one evening, some resident there, a family spotted what they described or what they thought was a gorilla, but this gorilla walked upright on 2 legs the entire time over the course of the evening, as it was sighted by several people. But initially the guy gets up and, I mean, he starts just trying, he was going to shoot the thing. I mean, just flat out. So, I mean, even if he did have a gorilla costume in the 1960s, which would have been just almost no one would have anything like that back then, that Death of Hollywood thing of that period.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, people are liable to shoot. So I think if you were to dress up and sneak around somebody's house at after dark, doing anything like this would have been a huge risk. And it just doesn't seem like there would be a hope. So these guys either did see a gorilla that has some miraculous ability to walk on 2 legs for very long periods of time all the way down the side of the highway and back into the woods, or else, again, we say it could, this sounds very much like they saw a Bigfoot, but they didn't know what a Bigfoot was in 1960 and just had no concept of that whatsoever. that the closest they could identify it as would be a gorilla. And they literally said, we got out an encyclopedia, looked through it, and that's how we decided it was a gorilla.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, this incident as well, I think he claimed to be 20 feet away from it when he shot it. Like, that's close enough to know what you're looking at. And I think often when people try to dismiss witnesses and encounters and things, they'll always point to the distance that people are. But this guy was disturbed by his dog getting agitated and barking. So he saw it through a window. Then he went to his front door and it was outside. And I think he said he got within 20 feet of it. He didn't want to get any closer because he was too scared. And that's when he shot it. So you just kind of think, well, how much of an eyewitness testimony are you going to actually listen to rather than just explain it all away?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you would think if he's that close, surely you can rule out that it was a person or some hokey costume or anything like that. So yeah, just again, it was some sort of an animal. If we can say that for sure.
Hmm. And then once again, this is one of those that we have this sort of flap and somebody else sees it trampling all over his vegetable patch in his garden. And he thought a mule had got out from somewhere. But then when people started digging into these encounters, it seemed that once again, it was one of those situations where a lot of people in the area were seeing things and coming across things, but nobody was either taking them seriously or they just didn't get any publicity.
Yeah, surely. I mean, stuff back then and even now, if it sounds outside the norm, people are just going to not take it too seriously, and the police, unless the thing is harming somebody. And I think the reason the police got involved here is because the guy's wife called originally and said, they're trying to shoot at it and the police don't want people shooting at things. And so they get involved. But otherwise, I don't know, if you say you see some big, hairy, tall, hair covered creature or monster, nobody's going to take it seriously. So a lot of that either, just exists in stories or fades away to history because people are not going to, document that thoroughly like somebody might do now if they were interested in these phenomenons.
And of course, one of the added aspects of this particular case is we've got the infamous monkey escaping from a zoo or circus, Lyle. And this is one of the other aspects of this that only came to light later on, that they were told that it had been captured and returned to the local zoo. But the problem with that is there wasn't a zoo.
Yeah, that's another one that always comes up. Well, it escaped from a circus train or a zoo or whatever else, but when you start kind of looking into it, that's just people sort of spouting off something that doesn't seem to line up with the facts, that there was, there was no zoo in the area or a circus that had lost a gorilla. I mean, it's like that's kind of news. If a circus is in town, the gorilla escapes, you figure that would have been in the newspapers first before people saw it. and if the circus lost its gorilla, wouldn't it still be there kind of going to the police asking if anybody had seen it? They wouldn't just drive off like, okay, well, I guess we lost that gorilla. Let's just leave. it's just none of that stuff, but it's just the recurring thing. The same thing is like, well, that was my cousin in a suit, or it was from a circus train wreck. And these come up as explanations by naysayers for every one of these cases.
Yeah. I think that the type of explanations that can only exist in a certain period of time, Lyle, because if somebody said that now, the first thing somebody would do was Google it and go, right, escaped gorilla, escaped monkey, look, nearest zoo, is there a circus passing through? When did it come through? Whereas in those days, if somebody said to you, yeah, it's just escaped from the zoo, you go, oh, okay.
Right, yeah. And so they would just take that as an answer. If somebody sounded like they knew what they were talking about and that was their opinion that it escaped from a zoo, well, it just became, oh, okay, well, that was it. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be echoed by other people from the time period. Oh, you know, that was just a certain, you know, it was escape from a zoo. And then you'd say, which zoo? Well, I don't know, the zoo. You know, that they just take it as fact. But now, yeah, you can, obviously news is more immediate. And if something like that happens, it becomes, somebody hears of it, and it's immediately somehow on the internet. Even if it's a small article, you can still find it, search it. You know, it would be more easy to verify or whatever, rule out, than back then. It was just, people just took people's word and that was it.
Yeah. I remember speaking with David Weatherly about one of his books, and that was an excuse. The old circus train crash, Lyle, came up for one of these strange creatures. And we were kind of postulating that clearly being a circus performer or artist in those days was really dangerous, going on the amount of circus trains that crashed around the US.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and there were some incidents where that actually happened, and usually, and you can find newspaper articles on those crashes, but at none of those circuses I could find that said that they had a 7-foot-tall, hair-covered, man-like creature fitting the description of Bigfoot that then ran into the woods. I'm like, circuses have, you know, camels and elephants, and they may have chimpanzees, but they do not have Bigfoots, and they don't have lizard men, and they don't have goat men.
Exactly.
So that explanation doesn't make sense, because even if there was a circus train crash, okay, fine, but the circus doesn't have a Bigfoot.
I think one of the later reports is one of those that kind of can give you goosebumps, because it's a bit of a strange one, and it's also one of those encounters where we see to find out the type of diet that hairy bipeds tend to enjoy. And this is a gentleman called Bill Simmons, who wasn't actually the person that had the original incident occurred to him, because he was contacted by a friend of his called Eddie, I believe, Lyle, who catch hogs. And he was disturbed one night by one of his hogs squealing and making a fuss, to go out and find that it clearly seemed that Bigfoot had come for a takeaway.
Right. Yeah. That was a very cool set of incidents. And, you know, I talked to this guy, Bill Simmons, a Texas resident, and while he didn't have the initial actual sighting, but he was there and kind of followed up in all of this and was there when they cast some tracks. But yeah, back in 1989, this guy, Eddie, who lived out in the Sulphur River bottoms, sort of in Northeast Texas, heard some squealing outside one afternoon and heard his hogs in the pen, you know, upset. He went out there and he saw this huge, hair-covered, tall, bipedal creature trying to pull one of those hogs out of the pen. And, I mean, you know, it's crazy, you know, to see something like that. So he went and grabbed his rifle and went off out there, and he fired several times at the thing, but the creature dropped the hog and ran off. And then thereafter called Simmons, and Simmons went down there and started to investigate. And he could see that there were several large 5-toed footprints that had been left around the pen areas. And they began to, you know, try to figure out what was going on. And they talked to a neighbor who then said, well, you know, there's a guy who lives right up here who also reported something like this, and they found some footprints. And eventually some guys from college showed up down there and actually cast one of the best example of these tracks. And you know, none of these people could figure out, you know, what this was. I mean, obviously it looked like a Bigfoot footprint, you know, that it wasn't human, and added up that Eddie saw this hairy thing trying to pull the hog out. So this has come up several times where apparently these creatures presumably have a diet and will eat hogs, because they're seen trying to either snatch them out of pens or actually jump on them in the wild. And so I included this incident sort of as an example of not only that there was a great footprint cast made that's one of the best I've seen out of Texas, but also just the fact that it illustrates what kind of diet they potentially have. And just this whole phenomenon of when one sighting happens and then you start talking to neighbors candidly about what you've seen, then suddenly other people say, well, you know, there's been other incidents around here, but, you know, nobody really just jumps up and reports those unless you really need to. And that sort of builds that credibility for the whole entire thing, that there is indeed something there because it's not just one person, but multiple people who've seen it.
Yeah. I think it shows you just how switched on Simmons was to treat this seriously, because obviously I think it was the fact that his friend was so shaken by what he witnessed, Lyle, that he just thought, yeah, he's clearly telling me the truth. But one of the interesting aspects that I have overlooked previously was that they'd had bulls killed by having their necks broken. And you just, you know, when we're talking about people just explaining things away, Lyle, they were thinking, oh, well, some predators attacked it. And you're thinking, well, what possibly going to be able to kill a bull with the greatest of respect and do it by breaking its neck?
Right. Yeah. And that, yeah, it's the other thing with sort of the strange livestock deaths. And, you know, obviously it would have to be, you know, a large predator of some kind, which there's not many that fit the bill. You know, maybe a cougar. Bears wouldn't do that. So, you know, and then some guy sees a Bigfoot. So, you know, once you sight some creature like that, then you sort of look in hindsight and say, well, you know, that could be an explanation for why these dairy bulls were mysteriously killed.
Mm. And it's the fact that Simmons kept hold of the casts that he'd made as well, because I know you mentioned Craig Woolheeder, who's done the foreword for the book, who's obviously deeply involved in the Texas Bigfoot Research Group down there, and obviously has done a lot of work in investigating cases all across the state and further on after his own particular sighting in the 90s, I think it was. Simmons had kept the cast and asked those guys to look into it, didn't he?
Yeah, that's how he ended up, this even became recorded in Bigfoot history here, is because Simmons became aware of Craig's group and eventually and contacted them, thinking, well, you know, these guys would be interested in this. Because, you know, like I said, it was back in 1989. So it wasn't for a little, you know, a decade or so before the group was formed. So Craig's group was instrumental in providing a place for people to start making reports back in the time. And over time, this obviously amassed a good selection of good reports. And, you know, in some cases, I could go back and actually find the original person, like Bill Simmons here, and I'm talking to him myself. But luckily that Craig had created this group at a time when there was, you know, there's very few places to report anything like this. So it was hugely important in preserving a lot of these stories that happened in Texas. And so, I mean, I owe great, you know, I couldn't have written the book without Craig because, and some of my colleagues, because they had documented stuff prior to my coming onto the scene in a way that, again, preserved the record of some of these that would have just probably been forgotten about or never reported.
Mm. Do you find it kind of strange that you've kind of gone full circle? Because obviously I know you mentioned in the book that when you were growing up, you would visit your relatives who lived up in the Piney, at the edge of the Piney Woods, Lyle. And so I think when you look at your body of work, sometimes you would presume that it would have been Bigfoot in Texas that set you off on the path, whereas it's almost as if you've come back to Texas to chase down Bigfoot.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's kind of ironic because you would think that would be the first and foremost. But it was really having seen the legend of Boggy Creek, which was sightings out of Arkansas when I was young, that really kind of, I don't know, cemented my fascination and kind of started me on the Boggy Creek thing. But Boggy Creek case was made just simply more famous because the movie had been made about it in the '70s and, it was very notable. But, you know, I think that, it was a natural progression that once I cover some of these other, I guess, famous cases on the whole, that I would come back and sort of try to document the encompassing history of the Texas Bigfoot, because there is sort of a ground zero for me that up which over my life I learned that there was a lot more Bigfoot sightings here than I would have even dreamed of and even knew of as a kid. I was too young with the Lake Worth monster thing. And then outside of that, they didn't write articles about Bigfoot in Texas newspapers, and I never saw any. And until I read some of John Green's books later, that I realized, there's sightings everywhere.
Mm.
But you know, it's the first thing that most people are exposed to is like the Patterson-Gellin film or tales of Sasquatch in the Pacific Northwest. And I was like everyone else, in my initial exposure to Bigfoot, that was in. That's where you thought Bigfoot existed, and that was sort of the end of the case until you discovered, oh wait, people were seeing these things all throughout the states and even in Texas.
Yeah. It is strange. I think it's one of those things, especially, I mean, obviously Arkansas is on the border of Texas towards the northeast, isn't it? So, it's not a massive stretch of imagination. If you want to talk about these creatures having some kind of intelligence, obviously the eastern side of Texas is where it starts to get very lush and very green, and borders Louisiana as well further down. So you're not a million miles away from some of these other strange reports in a vast expanse of land that, as we've said about strange creatures, well, they don't care about borders and traveling. If they'll go where their food is, if we're to believe that these creatures have some kind of intelligence. So for creatures such as this that we described that tend to be quite isolated and live in remote areas, places like this where you're on the borders of states are going to be perfect for them, because there's nobody there, really.
Right. You know, I mean, they're going to go to the places that make most sense for their survival. And, you know, just because I call it a Texas Bigfoot, that doesn't mean that it's roamed between Louisiana and Arkansas or visiting Texas. And briefly, it just, those kind of things are boundaries we set and sort of a way to classify or and gather stories in a, you know, a digestible fashion for a book. But ultimately, these things would roam piney woods, which stretch from Texas over into the swampier areas of Louisiana and on up into Arkansas, you know, through Boggy Creek and all up through the north and even over into Oklahoma. And if you look at all that stuff as a whole, there's just a ton of Bigfoot sightings and things that have happened over the years that rivals rivals any place. I mean, you know, it seems very significant and seems like there's definitely something to it. You know, this is not something people just made up one day. This is a long period of time in which people have recorded these things.
Mm. I think it would be, it would be remiss of me not to mention probably one of the most controversial alleged cases that appeared in the 1990s, which is this gentleman called Peter Sweeten, Lyle, who is one of those people that claimed to have caught Bigfoot on camera in the 90s, and it was shown on national television because he claimed he was being harassed by some secretive official from an organization that nobody could ever seem to find, or it didn't exist at all. So he decided to sell it to a TV network to get the footage out of his own hands, which is a strange thing to think about. But and I only recently saw this, probably in the last 12 months, so I wasn't really aware of Sweeten and his encounters. But there's some strange things about it. Is Sweeten the guy that claimed it charged it?
Yeah, it was, let's see, when he came upon it, it was laying on the ground, actually.
Mm.
And then when it became aware of him, it ran towards him as if it were angry. And Sweeten was carrying an old camera that was recorded on VHS tape, and he was filming some property in the San Houston National Forest, which is a very significant forest area in the Piney Woods. And this was back in 1997. So the camera was sort of, I mean, it wasn't a modern digital camera, but anyway, he managed to get some footage of this thing as it ran through the woods. And so it's kind of some controversial footage, and like most Bigfoot films, it's very inconclusive, but it eventually showed on a show called Strange Universe. And I included it here in the book is because, well, you know, we've got footprints, you know, or whatever. Has anybody ever taken some video footage of a creature that they claim is Bigfoot here in Texas? And this is a good example of that.
Mm.
And yeah, it's just one of those. It also has those elements of, well, supposedly some Wildlife Federation guy was hassling him, and that led to him letting the TV show air it, and just a lot of unanswered questions and sort of loose ends that can never be really verified. You know, it's an interesting film and just part in that Bigfoot history in Texas.
Yeah. It's one of those as well that seems to have split the great and the good in the world of cryptozoology. Because Peter Byrne always thought it was just a guy in a suit running about, whereas others think it could actually be real. But I think the added complication to this, and I know you mention it in the book, is that his story seems to change quite a bit, and he's got some really odd details. And I know he claimed one of the reasons he sold the tape was so he could have his teeth fixed, because it knocked two of his teeth loose or something strange.
Right. That, you know, as people question him, he would offer these explanations as to why he would sell it. And supposedly his teeth were knocked out, and people are trying to get him to show the dental bills to prove that. It's just sort of some, you know, sketchy parts of his story that they didn't really quite add up. But ultimately, there is a film of something, and you can see this film, and that's the bottom line. I mean, he's not lying about that he recorded something.
Mm.
And like all of these, then you have various, you know, guys into the subject that are looking at it, and they would have various opinions about it. And even my opinion of it is that it's just some of that inconclusive stuff. It's like, we can't say it's not a Bigfoot, but it kind of looks, it fits the proportions of a human. So it's in the human range, but it is really impossible to tell. So that's why it relies somewhat on the explanation and the story that given by the person who filmed it. That becomes a big part of it. Same as the Patterson-Gimlin deal, like, you know, that what they say about the circumstances of capturing the film are entered into evidence as much as the film itself. But ultimately, there's some split views on whether this is legitimate footage. And I asked a bunch of my colleagues what they thought, and some of them said, I think it could be real. Some of them said, nah, it's a hoax.
Mm.
So, it will remain unsolved as it is. But it again stands as an example of a film that an alleged Bigfoot film that was actually offered us in Texas.
Yeah. Tantalizingly frustrating as always, Lyle.
Pretty much all of it. So, these are intriguing stories, whether it results in some proof or not. At this point, it's still a lot of just going, wow, this is some wild stuff.
I was delighted as well to see that you revisited probably one of my favorite modern witnesses in this whole field of Bigfoot and strange creatures, which is the wonderful well, it's a matter of opinion if you think it's wonderful or not. I'm sure Paul doesn't think it is, which Paul Matlock's encounter from 2003, Lyle, which I think you originally printed in the marvelous Beyond Boggy Creek book back in 2014, I think it was. I've always found this encounter one of those that it clearly deeply affected the witness to a point that he seemed to be completely changed after it had happened to him.
Right. Yeah. This was a really dramatic eyewitness report by a guy named Paul Matlock, who saw a Bigfoot-like creature basically stalk and kill a wild hog in Far East Texas back in 2003. And I talked to this witness a while back, and it was the lead off in my Beyond Boggy Creek book, just simply because it's like so detailed and just wow. But he was hunting at the time and just watched this creature sneak up basically between the trees and then just jump on this hog, grab it, throw the hog against a tree and kill it. And the other hogs scattered. And again, this was in an area where there's a good significant amount of Bigfoot sightings. It's along the Sabine River, which is the border between Texas and Louisiana. And it's an extensive river. I mean, one of the longest rivers in Texas. And it extends a long way and runs right through the piney woods and very remote areas. And the place where Matlock was hunting, you could really only get there by boat because it was sort of sanctioned off with private property and other things. But just quite a dramatic event, and one that, as far as I can tell, I mean, he's being truthful about this, and it does kind of match up with others, like a guy Eddie saying he'd seen the Bigfoot trying to grab a hog out of its pen. So we do know that these things probably go after these hogs, and this was just an incident where the hunter was able to actually witness with his own eyes the Bigfoot killing the wild hog.
Mm. I think what separates this particular witness from a few that have come forward in the last 20 years or so is that not only did he look down the scope of his rifle to get a clear look at it, Lyle, so we can't even consider misidentification here at all, and also the fact that he's up in a tree stand. And as he's watching this strange encounter play out in front of him and this Bigfoot take down this hog viciously, he then realizes, rather terrifyingly, that the creature has spotted him and is staring at him. And that alone, I think, elevates this particular witness account to a different level for me, because you've got clear sighting, you've got an armed man up a tree stand, and the fact that this creature spots him, and he still didn't feel safe enough to fire on it.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to think you might shoot one of these things if you were to see it. But in that instance where he's sort of just sitting there looking at it and this thing is looking at him, that's when you really have a different perspective on just what this thing might be and how human-like it might be, is standing upright on two legs and all that sort of stuff. And he just felt like that it was risky to shoot it, and just because he didn't know what that, you don't have a real explanation for what it is. And also because if he didn't knock it down, he just seen this thing kill a big old hog. It could just simply pull him out of the tree stand and kill him. So all we could really do is just stand there. And luckily the thing heard a whoop from the woods and picked up the hog and walked off, thankfully. But very scary, as you can imagine, how scary that would be to be in that position where one minute you either don't believe in Bigfoot or you don't even care or have no thought about it. And then suddenly you're sitting there looking at one and it's looking at you. Totally, totally life-changing.
Yeah. And he's quite fortunate in the fact that, obviously, after the event, his cousin finds him looking shaken and pale and says to him, "What's happened?" And as with any situation like this, people are obviously very sort of reticent about being honest, Lyle. But the surprising end to this is the fact that he tells his cousin what's happened, and his cousin says, yeah, I know, I've seen it as well.
Right. There again, once you start talking about this subject, then lo and behold, you realize that you're not the only one that's seen it. Not, I don't know if that comforts you or makes it even worse, but, yeah, he said his cousin, you know, that point divulged that he had seen something and hadn't said anything about it up until that point. But it just, you know, corroborates the story.
Yeah. Well, I think the last bit I'd like to touch on is obviously there is one particular place in Texas that's essentially ground zero, which is Jefferson, Lyle. It's one of those places, I think, as we've talked throughout the book, a lot of people who may not know much about the history of Bigfoot in Texas will be very surprised about that. Jefferson seems to be a real hotspot, that there's been encounters and witnesses going back decades in this particular place. So for anybody who's no idea about whereabouts Jefferson is or its locality in the state, could you tell us a little bit about Jefferson and its history in regards to strange creatures?
Jefferson is located in the far eastern portion of Texas, right in the northern part of the Piney Woods. It's sort of northeast Texas, really. And it's just in a beautiful area that's, you know, huge pine trees, a lot of lakes and creeks and waterways. And it's just a small town that's kind of nestled into the woods there between the bayous and a place called Caddo Lake, which is a very swampy, primordial looking landscape that you almost can imagine creatures like this living if you go there.
Sure.
And Jefferson has a long history, beginning with some wild newspaper reports back in 1965, in which first a young man said that he was chased by this upright, hairy creature down a road one day as he was walking home from fishing. And that made the newspapers. And then shortly thereafter, other people began hearing strange howls in the woods around there and found footprints. And there was other sightings. And then, as these things tend to do, once it's in the paper, some old timers came up and said, well, you know, years ago, I saw something like this. And that all resulted in law officials and citizens organizing, quote unquote, monster hunts to go in search of this creature. And that all sort of became part of the East Texas Bigfoot history. And Jefferson is the location where Craig Woolheater puts on the annual Texas Bigfoot Conference.
Mm.
So that's been a reason why it's just sort of become the Bigfoot capital of Texas, if you will, just a sort of a center point and a hot spot of, you know, this phenomenon. And you know, I've been out there and I've been in those woods. I've interviewed some people who've had sightings over the years, and there's some quite credible sightings that date back years ago and even recently, where people are still seeing this. And certainly those woods are thick and dark and swampy areas. And if there was such a thing living in Texas, certainly this could be a place where they could survive.
Mm. Oh, it certainly seems like it's the perfect habitat for them, no doubt about that.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that kind of comes full circle back to the idea that Texas is not just sort of the John Wayne landscape of cowboy movies. There is definitely heavily wooded, piney woods, even swampy areas that would surprise you if you visited here and say, oh, well, this is Texas. But and not coincidentally, that's where pretty much a majority of the Bigfoot sightings in the state have been reported, all in that eastern portion with the Piney Woods.
Mm. Fabulous. Fabulous. So, Lyle, thank you so much for diving into this wonderful new book with me. Just before I let you leave and we can point everybody in the direction of following your numerous talents, your wonderful new podcast, Monstro Bizarro, has been running this year. So why on earth did you, no, not that I'm criticizing you, Lyle, I think it's amazing, but why on earth did a man so busy as you, Lyle, decide that you needed to do more with your life?
Right, I know. I asked myself, why on earth did I start these things? But
well, we're glad you do.
Right, it just kind of, And people have asked me for years, why don't you do a podcast? And, you know, I've done narration for a lot of small town monsters documentaries and that sort of thing. And I just didn't have time. You know, it's just only so many hours in the day, and I still also active in my band and music. And but, you know, over the years, podcasts have become obviously quite popular, and it was just something I thought, well, you know, I should try to do something like this. Only really, I promised so far one episode a month, and it's a different format where I don't interview people. I just sort of tell about these cases and some of my insight, and just sort of lead the listener on a journey a little bit. It's a little bit like old radio, sort of a old radio play / audio book. Where I add in the sound effects and other things. It's been fun, and the response to it was overwhelmingly that people loved the format and loved it. So I guess now I got to continue that among all my other endeavors. But yeah, it's definitely been very well received, and something that I think, well, okay, you know, I'm on the right track here. So definitely gonna balance this in with the books and everything else and proceed.
Yeah. Is it a case of trying to deal with your favorite cases? Because obviously each episode you tend to focus on a particular aspect of cryptids or a specific famous case. And I know the last one you did was about the wonderful Bishopville Lizard Man, which is obviously a book that you've written covering that crazy case from the 80s. But also you've done a couple of Bigfoot episodes. You've also touched Mothman. So is it kind of like your greatest hits of your favorite cases, Lyle, or is it just things that you're really interested in?
Well, you know, in some ways, I'm able to cover some things that I haven't necessarily written about or written a book on in the past, like Mothman. But also, you know, I'm also able to offer some, a bit of an audio version of the cases I have studied, you know, for those that may not sit down and read books or whatever. Now I can offer it in a bit different format. So it kind of just ranges between things I've already covered in some aspect and things that I haven't been able to cover before. So it gives me, you know, some different options. And so as we go forward, it depends on, you know, when I add new things, and that takes extra research. And if, you know, I can also hinge off what I've already done. So it will just encompass whatever, just trying to cover a range of cryptid things. And, you know, I've got other ideas that I can expand upon if I can continue this.
Well, I look forward to seeing what you deliver next month. I'm always enjoying it. I devour it intently, though. The Bigfoot attacks episode left me a bit creeped out, I have to say, Lyle.
Well, in some ways, I'm all about the spooky stories, you know, my podcast is sort of on the spooky vibe, because I like that aspect of, again, just, man, if you saw something like this out there in the woods, especially if you were alone or if something like that were to attack you, man, it would just be a scary situation. So I do play that.
Absolutely. Well, long may it continue. So what's next, Lyle? I know as we touch, and I always dislike sort of making it sound as though I'm telling people they need to do something else, Lyle, because I know you, as we joked about, you are incredibly busy with a variety of projects. So have you got anything else lined up? I know you're probably recovering from a hectic conference schedule on top of everything else you do.
Yeah, there's been a lot of travel this year, and, you know, trying to get the podcast in there among the books and keep up with the band and what all. But it just gonna, right now it's just a bit of all of that juggling, and I've already scheduled so many things for the next year, and then somewhat concentrating trying to do the podcast. You know, it's like, that's in, you know, that I'm on a schedule there, whereas a book, I just kind of write it till it's done, and then I put it out. Where it's sort of kind of, I'm sort of on this schedule of delivering one a month. So that's just kind of become my focus for now, just to try to catch up and just to deliver the things that need to be done in a timely manner, and whatever I write next in the format of a book, I can figure that out later.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly you find settling down on a Friday night to do podcast editing quite relaxing, whereas before you'd probably be thinking about which bar you could hit.
All right, yeah, there's a lot less of that. Heck, I played in rock bands for since I was in high school, so I had no lack of bars and being out or whatever, so I don't mind doing whatever. This is all fun, so it's all good either way. It's never really work, even though it is work, but it's fun work, so I don't mind doing it whenever I need to.
Brilliant. So, Lyle, where can everybody track down your work, get a copy of your latest book, and download the podcast and keep up to date with everything else you've got going on, sir?
Well, my website, lyleblackburn.com, has links to everything, and I have an online store there where you can get autographed copies of my books. They're also available on Amazon in paperback, some in hardback, and in ebook, and now in audio format even. And my Monstro Bizarro podcast can be found on all major podcast platforms. So you can search that out or search Lyle Blackburn podcast. And what else? My band Ghoul Town, there's links to that as well from my LyleBlackburn.com website.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything, which will probably be an extremely extensive list, Lyle, that you do, so people can hit you up on all those aspects. And I just want to say thank you as always. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, as it always is when you spend time in your company. And thank you for fitting me in, because I know you're an extremely busy man, but you always arrange things to spend some time with me. And I'm always deeply thankful that you can fit me in. And I look forward to whatever projects you've got planned, and I look forward to seeing what else you've got down the pipeline, sir.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed being on your show. So I always make it a point to sit down in the schedule. So thanks for having me as usual.
My pleasure. Take care, Lyle.
Thanks so much.